Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Open Book, a weekly show about literature, spirituality, and new ways of seeing God in everyday, ordinary, day-to-day life. As always, I am Lori Strawn, and I was being joined by my co-host, Alice Shelton. She's my buddy, my pal. I'm hoping she will call back in. Today, we are going to talk about C.S. Lewis, who is one of our very favorite authors on the show. And here's Alice back again. Hi, Alice.
Thanks, Lori. Sorry about
that. No problem.
A little technical difficulties.
No problem. Well, as I was saying, C.S. Lewis, he's one of our very favorite authors on the show. He's known primarily for his fiction writing, including the Narnia series for children. But he was a serious poet, too. The first poem we're going to talk about today is called Pilgrim's Problem. By now, I should be entering on the supreme stage of the whole walk, reserved for the late afternoon. The heat was to be over now, the anxious mountains, the airless valleys and the sun-baked rocks behind me. Now, or soon now, if all is well, come the majestic rivers of foamless charity that glide beneath forests of contemplation. In the grassy clearings, humility with liquid eyes and damp, cool nose should come, half-tame, to eat bread from my hermit hand. If storms arose, then in my tower of fortitude, it ought to have been in sight by this, I would take refuge. But I expected rather a pale mackerel sky, feather-like, perhaps shaking from a lower cloud light drops of silver temperance and clover earth sending up mists of chastity, a country smell, till earnest stars blaze out in the established sky, rigid with justice, the streams audible, my rest secure. I can see nothing like all this. Was the map wrong? Maps can be wrong, but the experienced walker knows that the other explanation is more often true. Well, Alice, Pilgrim of this poem was expected his journey to go a little bit different way. He's surprised that it has not gone this way. Looking at your own life journey, are you surprised by where you are? What surprises you and why?
Well, you know, I have to say, I'm not totally surprised. I guess there are probably, and what you're asking is what parts did surprise. There are some little parts that surprised me. I'm surprised that I still feel, at 50, I can really still really connect back to my 25-year-old self, my 30-year-old self. I mean, like I can, I don't feel as old as I thought I would feel at this age.
Yeah,
you know, because
from that
age, I would, you know, you look at people and you think, oh, that person seems a certain age, but so that's one thing. Am I surprised? I think a surprise for me is that I, for a good period of my life, I feel like I was pretty progress and career and accomplishment focused, and I'm surprised at how that has begun to move away as importance. I'm very interested now in developing other people, and so the success of the people who work with me or for me is a lot more important than my own success. I mean, not, you know what I mean, my own accomplishments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm totally with you on that.
And I like that. I mean, that is a refreshing thing that's an unexpected surprise. I think the other positive thing that's an unexpected surprise is I'm just becoming more patient with the process. I'm more patient kind of putting things on the shelf and not having to act immediately and finding out that for most things in life, if you don't do them today, there's really not that big a consequence.
That's true.
More imagined than I thought. You know, I have a better perspective on what's urgent and what's not. So what about you?
Yeah, I'm resonating with everything you're saying. I'm surprised that I'm not more success-oriented. As you know, I was very driven in my younger years to be a top student, top worker, and it kind of burnt me out. Now I just kind of want to be happy and a good person. And that feels aspirational enough. I always imagined that by 50, good grief, I'd be a rich and famous writer. Instead, I'm poor but content. Maybe riches and fame are still in the offing. You never know. But I don't go seeking them like I used to.
Yeah. I mean, I can say that I would daydream about what life would be like if I had more financial freedom than I do or whatever. But yeah, I'm with you. It's really not my pursuit anymore, and I don't feel that my life will be somehow less. I'm enjoying it's kind of like, here's another thing. Years ago, I was not able to put a book down if I got halfway through it and thought, this is crap, I'm not finishing this. I would force myself through it.
Oh, yeah.
And now I literally can read like a chapter and go, not doing this, going back to the library.
Yes, that is so, so true. Didn't you think that by 50 you'd be like more dignified in some way?
Yeah. Well, yeah, yes and no.
I didn't realize I'd be the
I
same
probably
silly
did.
Person.
We're dignified when we need to be dignified. I told my sister recently that I think she got judged as a younger person as more wild than she was, and I think I have allowed myself to be judged as more tame than I am, and so we're both finding as we're this age that, you know, what the balance is, what the reality is on that. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Well, from the clues in the poem, I would say that the pilgrim is about at the same point we are in our journeys, or maybe just a little bit further on. Do you agree, and what kind of signs tell you this?
Yeah, I would agree, and I think the self-awareness shown in the last stanza, I can see nothing like all this, was the map wrong, maps can be wrong, that the experienced walker knows that the other explanation is more true, and I think the other explanation is the expectations were not right, or the expectations were present and the reality didn't meet him, perhaps. But
yeah,
I think he's about where we are, he or she, I think it's he, trying to grapple with, you know, a little bit dying to dreams, reconciling expectations with reality, maybe even recognizing for the first time that there were expectations that were kind of unknown, unstated, unhonored. And that's very much where I feel like I'm unbundling some things where I had expectations that I didn't really even know I had. And dealing with the disappointment of that and kind of where those came from. But I relate to the poet a little bit in the, I was thinking it would be more of a pale blue mackerel sky. You know, I had thought that things would slow down some. I had thought that I wouldn't still have such strong, passionate reactions when I was disappointed or let down or angry. You know, you hope that somehow those, so we've got work to do is the message, I think, there.
Yes, yes. And while I know just biographically that this is probably C.S. Lewis talking about finding love in his late middle age with his wife, Joy, which I know was a big surprise to him, I think we're all kind of surprised about where our journeys take us. Because as a culture, we look at old age as sort of a, well, that's a settled time. We'll all somehow be wise and we'll be content. And it never occurs to us, really, that we keep learning as our pilgrimage continues, and that means we keep struggling, and that maybe we never get to a place of quiet contentment. Life evolves, but it doesn't get easier, I don't think.
No. Well, and maybe it's a conversation we've had where we've discussed the concept of learning. I'm becoming more and more convinced, in part from my own life and in part from watching my mother-in-law's life winding down, that a lot about growing in a journey and being a pilgrim is more to do with unlearning than learning.
Wow, that's profound.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have a lot of stuff packed into who we are that comes from a lot of different places. And what I'm feeling like I'm watching her doing, and let me give you an example of it.
Okay.
An example of it is you know, the people that her three children are now, and their weaknesses and their deficiencies and the things that you know, they struggle with on a human level and that I struggle with about them on a human level comes up sometimes. And her response often as I'm grappling through that and trying to get some insight from her is to say, you know, Alice, I know those three children of mine in a place that has nothing to do with today. How I know them is from inside myself. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's beautiful because what it says is I can acknowledge who they are and not have to grapple with those weaknesses. I know them in a place, and I'm going to stay in that good place where I know them in that way. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, it really is. How beautifully put.
Mm-hmm. And that to me is a lot about relearning and letting go and forgiving and moving on and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Goodness. Well, you talked anyway, a little bit about that last bit. Maps can be wrong, and the experienced walker knows that the other explanation is more often true, and that the explanation is, of course, that you are wrong in your calculations and expectations. Or we all are anyway.
Or you were wrong to believe there was a map in the first place.
yeah, exactly. Or that the map would stay the map that you thought it was going to be.
Exactly.
What would you say the lesson of the poem is? I would say that it's mostly that life is always open to surprise and never think that you know where you are going because there's going to always be twists and turns, and many of them can be very happy ones if you keep your eyes open to them.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, to me, the old adage of, you know, plan and then live the way life presents itself to you. I mean, you have to be open to serendipity. You have to be open to providence, or you don't have to. But life will be more interesting and fulfilling and all those things if you can be.
Yes, that, exactly. Well, here's our next poem. It's called Simply Prayer. Master, they say that when I seem to be in speech with you, since you make no replies, it's all a dream, one talker aping two. They are half right, but not as they imagine. Rather, I seek in myself the things I meant to say, and lo, the wells are dry. Then seeing me empty, you forsake the listener's role, and through my dead lips breathe and into utterance wake the thoughts I never knew. And thus you neither need reply nor can. Thus, while we seem two talking, thou art one forever, and I no dreamer but thy dream. What is this poem saying about prayer, Alice?
This one took me back a little bit because it put into words a lot about what I think about prayer. I'm not taking credit for the poem, Lori, if you're thinking that.
I'm not.
What it's saying is most of us grapple with when I'm praying and I'm quiet and still, am I making up God's response? You know, am I having this conversation where I'm both the listener and the responder? And it's a wonderful way of expressing it because what I think it says is because God is in you and God created you, you are necessarily having a conversation, two people or one person having a conversation with two people or one person or vice versa. I mean, you are inextricably of God, and so there's no way that your prayer is going to be the type of conversation that any other conversation is going to be. It is going to be mixed up, crazy, weird, and you're never going to be truly sure until you are, what the prayer was or what the answer was, you know?
Exactly. It's not going to operate like a human discussion. God is going to be participatory on both ends of the conversation. And especially,
exactly,
I think, when we feel most empty, I feel that God comes to us and through us. And so prayer becomes a gift, and we end up, I think, having a more heartfelt and deeper connection than we would be capable if we really were on our own.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we carve prayer out as sort of, you know, we can sort of give and stipulate to the fact that all things are of God and it's all God. But for some reason, I think human beings kind of carve out prayer as I am deciding what it is that I am praying to God for, when in reality, that is no different than anything else about our lives. It's all God-given. And so even the prayer that we think we're directing to God, it is is essence created by God. You know, so
yeah.
So that's that meaning then, just as you and I think have tried to pray about and be about in our lives, all of life is prayer. It
yes.
really is, if you think about it that way. Because all of life is a way of communicating with God, whether we see it that way or not.
Yes, yes. Well, do you experience this sort of feeling when you're praying? And do you think the poet's explanation is fits your description, fits your reality?
I think it does. I mean, I certainly can think of many different examples of prayer time where either I'll be praying and I'll then be thinking, this is God's response to what I'm praying, or I will suddenly, and particularly when I pray through writing, I will feel God take over what is being done on the page. I mean, I will kind
yeah.
of have that experience of awakening, this, my lips breathing what God is saying, and God taking over that role. So, I don't know. Does that answer you?
Yes, it does. And funny, the thing that you just said, it reminds me, my friend Maggie was telling me just this past week that she has been in a very difficult situation, that sometimes she finds that the words coming out of her mouth are not premeditated at all and don't even really sound like her. And she
mm-hmm.
really feels like that's the Holy Spirit working through her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you and I have shared times when we really are focused in writing, that we can get beyond a writing experience and read what we've written and realize, I didn't write that. That's
yeah.
not, I mean, I have no recall of having written that,
uh-huh.
and, you know.
Yeah,
and
I
that,
could
to
never
me, that's,
be that funny or, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love this, the feeling that is expressed in this poem. Really, I think that feeling of oneness, two-ness is the highest point in my relationship with God, because it is so all-encompassing and all connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really, I'm very taken with both of these poems. They're very insightful. They're very accessible to me. And I think partly because I understand them experientially. If you had said, let's talk about these 10 years ago, 20 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, I'm not sure I would have been able to really, I might have read them and gone, okay, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have sounded like Wordsworth to me. Well, that's, you know,
yeah.
a very beautifully put experience that you have, but I don't
yes.
see myself in it.
Yes, and I think that's one of the beauties of poetry. As I move on in age, I realize things that I did dismiss as a younger person are much more interesting to me, partly because I don't feel like I have to make every single word make some kind of profound significance. You know,
mm-hmm.
I can read a line and think about it and, you know, cast it away or do something more with it or whatever. It's just, you don't have to make sense of the whole thing. It's going to speak
right.
to different points in your life differently.
Yes. Very much so. Yeah, I kind of want to go back and study all of literature again to
mm-hmm.
see from a new point of view.
And that's why scripture works, frankly, because you've got
right.
such a variety of literary types, and you can go back and at very different points in your, even in your day sometimes, see something very different come off the page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Well, here's our last poem of the day, and I know this one was a little more challenging for you, but I think we're going to persevere. It's called The Apologist's Evening Prayer. From all my lame defeats and oh, much more, from all the victories that I seem to score, from cleverness shot forth on thy behalf, at which, while angels weep, the audience laugh, from all my proofs of thy divinity, thou who wouldst give no sign, deliver me. Thoughts are but coins. Let me not trust instead of thee their thin, worn image of thy head. From all my thoughts, even from my thoughts of thee, O thou fair silence, fall and set me free. Lord of the narrow gate and the needle's eye, take from me all my trumpery, lest I die. Why do you suppose this is called the apologist's prayer? Are we all apologists, and should we be?
Okay, I should have looked up apologists in the dictionary, but by apologist, we're talking about someone who who testifies, basically?
One who's making an apology, basically.
One who is apologizing for something?
Yeah. Now, see, okay, I'll just go ahead and
jump
right in.
Please go with it, because I'm not getting it.
That's all right. To me, I feel this is a prayer of humility and an appropriate way to approach prayer. And I relate to this poem very keenly as a writer, because I can write clever things and spiritual things and things that gain attention. But in the end, at the end of the day, what do I know? Cleverness is just a cheap facade. I'm no authority on God. And attention is purely self-gratifying. None of that is going to stand me in better stead with God. And I think all writers kind of put up this sort of front, essentially. And it's good to come out from behind that front and admit that we're nothing. We're maybe potential tools in the hands of God, and that we ought not to buy into our own hype. And I think there are a lot of occupations that are like that. Think of doctors or lawyers. It's good to take off the persona at the end of the day and stand before God in all of our weakness and frailty and just say, you know what, I might have sounded like a big blowhard, but I'm nothing.
But I'm nothing.
You know it and I know it.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I read from the poetry, from the poem. but honestly, the name is not what I would have given it. And that doesn't, I suppose that shouldn't change anything. But because to me, it was really about humility. And it was about kind of coming to the recognition you just described. But I had, my brain was trailing in a different thought about apologist. Because I'm thinking, isn't an apologist someone who... There's some religious tone for that word. I mean, somehow evangelical is coming to my mind. Isn't there an apologetics?
I first went to literary apologists. You know, like Chaucer at the end of his life apologized for having written Canterbury Tales because it wasn't very godly. And there are a lot of writers who do that at the end of their lives. They go back and say, oh, you know what, I really apologize for all those things I wrote because they were, you know, they weren't of God. They were too mortal and, you know, goofy and dirty and whatever. That, to me, is where I went with apologist.
Okay. Well, and that makes sense. I mean, and then in which case, I think, yes, we are all apologists, because at the end of our lives, we, you know, in the evening of our lives, as the poem suggests, we need to be dumping all that stuff. And in order to end up being humbly prepared to meet God. But I'm telling you, I got to look up apologetics when we're finished, because I know that it feels like there's some theological course that you can take called apologetics, but I could just be making that up.
You're not making that up. There is something, and you're awakening that little flicker of memory from humanities.
Is that about apologizing? I mean, that's what I'm trying. That's kind of why I was confused by this, because I was making that connection and I didn't take the time to look it up. So maybe we need to just look it up and talk about it another time.
Indeed, maybe. Okay. Well, the poet does ask to be delivered from things that you would think are good things: his victories, his cleverness, and even he says to be set free from his thoughts. From his thoughts of God, even. Why do you suppose he asks those things?
Well, I go back to, you know, saints and individuals like St. Francis of Assisi, who, and just biblical, you know, scriptural thing of a person shall give away all that they own and all that they have, and you know, leave that behind and follow God. I think it's within that context. I think it's stripping down the facade, stripping down, taking responsibility for anything that's good or right about their lives, to be able to just more clearly honor and serve God. I think that's, in a nutshell, what is being said there.
Yes, because they're human things, and they're not necessarily conducive to true spiritual life. And we should never think that we've gotten a sure hold on God, for sure, because we're almost certainly mistaken if we do.
Yeah. Well, and I guess I want to pose back and push back a little bit with you. You know, are victories and things like cleverness, you know, are those good things? I mean, have we just as a society deemed certain things good things, mm-hmm. bad things, when they're really, those are assigned values that we're placing on them?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think about
absolutely
in our, yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. And as we're speaking, I have looked up apologist, which says, in the dictionary, one who speaks or writes in defense of a faith, a cause, or an institution.
Yeah.
So
that,
there you
go. Yeah. And see, that was, to me, very different from what this I thought this poem was doing. So, yeah, that mm-hmm. makes sense. It,
okay.
So, to me, kind of it is kind of like evangelical in a way.
It is. Yeah. Well, okay. What is the poet talking about when he talks about the narrow gate and the needle's eye? What sort of relationship do you think he ultimately wants with God?
Well, I think he's following up to the whole concept of being delivered from victories and cleverness. He is kind of thinking that he needs to become very small. He needs to become
yeah.
small in order to let God become larger. And so he's seeking a servant relationship or a very humble relationship where he sees himself as small and God as great.
Yes. And I'm reminded very much of a poem that I know we've talked about before, in which a king mutters to himself, "Have mercy on me, a fool."
Mm-hmm.
Very much the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he may look like
yeah.
a big man in the human world, but he needs to be humble and small to fit through that
yeah.
gate and come into God's presence.
Yeah, I think that's neat. I want to tell you, these three were fabulous, and I assume you took them from some anthology of Lewis's
mm-hmm.
poetry, because I would love to send me that name, because
okay.
I would love to find more. These are really beautiful, and I suspect a lot of the others he's written would touch in on this time in life for us. So, very cool. Neat for prayer.
Yes, indeed. And that's our show for this week. Due to scheduling horrors, we will not be here next week, but we'll talk to you the week after that. So until then, if you're looking for God, just open a book.
Have a great week.